no further ado, I think we should give the floor to Martina. So thank you very much, everybody, for coming. And we'll start with the presentation, then quick intervention from panelists, and then your questions.
Great. Thanks, Robert, and nice meeting you all. Well, I will share my screen, and I have some slides for the presentation. And well, I have like 15 minutes to talk with you about the digital trade integration project. It's a project that brings together different partners. The LSE is one of them. I will tell you more about what the project is about and what are the findings of the first output, which is the database of digital trade integration. So I will start by telling you a bit about the project, what it is, and what are the different objectives, and then show you some preliminary findings by region, income level, and show you what we have in the database covering over now 102 countries. It keeps increasing like every week. And then the next steps of the project. So regarding the DTI project, we have three main outputs. The first is to create a network of people working on digital trade. There is still not enough in terms of sharing expertise, best practices. So the first step for us was to organize webinars, which we met, discussed digital trade issues. And it started as a Civica project. I don't know if you all know, Civica is a new partnership consortium of universities working on mainly in political science across Europe. LSE, the UI, Bocconi, and the ERT are four of those universities and are the partners of our project. But in total, I guess there are eight now universities in the Civica consortium. But then because of the topic, we expanded beyond university and now we have different other partners outside academia. The other objective is to have an open database. Now this database is online for the first 100 countries, but we are still expanding the coverage. And the third output is a digital trade integration index that we are working on and we plan to launch next year. These are the partners of the project. So as I was saying, universities, we have Bocconi, ERT, LSE, and the UI as part of the Civica Consortium. Then we have three UN regional commissions for Latin America, Asia, and Africa that are helping us to gather data from the ground. And then we have ESAI, a think tank based in Brussels, the DCO, that is a new international organization based in the Middle East that is helping us with data in the Middle East, and the TISA network in Australia. So the reason why we have all these partners is that we wanted to have as broad of a coverage and understanding of digital trade as possible. The understanding of certain type of policies is very different across regions and across countries. So we try to take understanding and include all these different perspectives in our project. It's almost impossible to find a common agreement, but I think we try to include areas that are generally and commonly considered to be restrictive for digital trade or enabling integration. Why is this important? First of all, for transparency and understanding. On digital trade, there's still not enough clarity on what is really good or bad, or like what is the different perspectives or points of view on this issue across the world. So that's the first kind of value added of this initiative. Having a database like this allows to do structured comparison across countries, and we are starting to do that with a new study, and having all this very easily accessible open data allows to have a very quick and simple comparison across countries in different areas. We can then conduct quantitative analysis with this kind of information, and we are starting. I will show you at the end of the presentation a couple of gravity analysis results that we are starting to run with this data. And then by doing quantitative analysis, then we can gather best practices and provide inputs to policymakers, which is how ideally policy should be done, with the actual data that supports the implementation of new policies. There are a couple of other initiatives out there. There's the OECD Digital SDRI, and there is a new database by the Global Trade Alert, School Digital Policy Alert. Why have we done this database and this project? First of all, we provide value added by having a broad definition of digital trade. We cover ICT goods, we cover data, services, FDI, and in a way that is as broad as possible, so that we can cover all sorts of policies that could have an impact on digital trade. We have a database and an index, which is not the case for other initiatives. we focus on integration. So compared to the digital SDRI of the OECD, we move from restrictiveness to integration. And I will we'll tell you in a moment how we do it. It is an academic initiative, so we don't have anyone that can tell us what we can or cannot include in our database. And we have a broad country coverage. As I was telling you, we have 100 countries as of now that are already published, but we have two other databases that are about to be published for Oman and Jordan. And also by the end of this year, we'll have 10 more. Next year, we already have committed with the UN ICA to include all the rest of African countries. So this database is expanding, and these are all the different partners that help us to collect data from all these countries. I personally worked with one person from each country to collect data with people that understood the local environment, understood the language, and that would help us to then gather and collect all this data. And we are covering all regions and all income levels, but we are now striving to include more LDCs, for example, and increase the coverage. So this is the methodology. I will not go into this because we will need a few hours, but just to say that we have different, these are all the policy areas and type and policies that we consider relevant for digital trade. They are divided in 12 pillars, and within each pillar, there are different topics. The pillars include both traditional type of policies, for example, tariffs, but also new policies, just data policies, intermediate liability, content access, online payments, etc. What is important is that we, for each of those areas, we have both restrictions and enabling policies. So that's where integration comes from. We don't only look at restrictions, but we also want to take into account enabling policies. So for the restrictiveness part, we include policies in our database under like three broad rationales, which is also what usually a trade restriction is. So we include policies that create a differential treatment between domestic and foreign firms. We include policies that differentiate online versus offline. So for example, treating ebooks differently from books. And also we include some policies that are considered to be especially trade distortive for the objective that they want to achieve. This is, for example, some data policies would fall under this category. And then we have the enabling part, in which we look whether the country has failed to adopt specific legislation, could be consumer protection, data protection, or also other international agreements that are important for digital trade. For example, the UNCITRAL model laws on e-signatures and electronic transactions, the WTO government procurement agreement, etc. So we list a few legislation or agreements that we consider relevant for digital trade. And this is the paper where you find all of this. So I will not go in detail into each of the pillars, but we have published a working paper, and if you have comments also, they are very welcome. How we collected, I already told you a bit. So we worked with local experts, then data was validated by the investigators, and also we sent it to the government authorities. Some of them replied with comments, others didn't. When they did, we took into account the comments and improved the database. In other cases, we anyway published the data for now, but we always welcome comments, and we are improving the data and updating it really on a daily basis. So the database is also kind of living and improving. And for the sources, we mainly rely on laws and regulations and then guidelines. And as secondary sources, we use also other databases, of course. And we always, for each entry in our database, we always add the reference to the law, the reference to the source of our entry. So that's it about the project, very broad overview. And in terms of results, we already have now, as I was saying, 102 countries. And I want to show you a bit what we found. First of all, this graph puts the regions and shows the number of measures expected to have a restrictive impact. So all the restrictions on digital trade. Asia Pacific is the region with the highest number of measures on average, while Europe is the least. For Europe, like, we're still working on this because it's very hard to have the national data sets. We have to include the European laws. So for now, we have a EU data set and national data sets. I expect that when we improve and actually merge those two databases, the Europe will be higher in terms of number of measures. And then you see a bit the other regions here. And in terms of income levels, it's interesting also from like a development perspective that low income countries are found to be the most restrictive, then followed by upper middle income, so the emerging economies are there, and then high income countries are those that have the least number of restrictions. The other side of the medal is enabling measures. On the enabling measures, we have Europe as the biggest implementer of those measures, and Africa is the least, the region with the least number of those measures being implemented. And for income levels, this follows a bit what we kind of would expect, I would say. So then by region, I want to show you a bit what we find within each of the regions. For Africa, we have 29 countries covered so far. The average is 34 measures for each country. And with this database, you can create very easily those kind of graphs in which you see like how many measures each country implements that are expected to be restrictive. So this is just the count of measures. It doesn't say much about the actual restrictiveness of each measure we are working on for the index, but this already provides an overview about the also activity of the country in this area. Namibia, Madagascar, Uganda, Togo, Eswatini, these are the least active countries on digital trade. For Africa, you can also, by looking at the 12 pillars we have, you can also see where countries are most active. In Africa, there is less restrictions on goods, ICT goods. So quantitative trade restrictions, technical standards, we find little there. Also FDI, the countries are pretty open on investment in Africa. On the other hand, we find more restrictions on online sales, transactions, IP, and telecom. That is pretty restrictive. And we have a total of 988 measures in Africa. On the enabling side, that's the other picture. So we see that in some cases, countries that are most restrictive are also those that impose less enabling measures. In other cases, it's not always the case. Like Morocco is one of the most restrictive countries, but also one that has a lot of enabling measures. So it really depends. Here you see a bit. The picture. Asia Pacific, here we have an outlier that is always China, is also the most restrictive country in our database. And then on the other hand, we have small service oriented economies like New Zealand, Singapore, Hong Kong, Vanuatu. In terms of areas, we see again ICT goods, so tariffs, technical standards among the most open areas. On the other hand, again, telecom, online sales, and FDI, so more restrictions on investment in Asia. And as I was saying, the average is 46, so it's on average more restrictive than Africa. And on the enabling measure side, again, we see all these open service-oriented economies that are also engaged actively in imposing these enabling measures. So this is kind of what we would expect. On the other hand, smaller, more developing economies having less of those policies in place. And Latin America. For Latin America, with Cuba found to be very restrictive. I guess this is not a surprise. It's very hard also to access the internet in Cuba. But also they are very active in controlling all sorts of policies. On the other hand, we have El Salvador, Dominican Republic, Guatemala being very open, and Chile, of course, that is also very active in exporting their policy approach on digital trade across the region. And for policy measures, Latin America is really open when it comes to content. So no censorship, no blocking. Most of the countries are really open online, and also data policies are on the open side. On the other hand, more restrictions on online sales, public procurement, telecom. And for the enabling sites, there is more like self-explanatory at this point, but you have Mexico being the most active, and you have Cuba. The last region is Europe and North America. I put them together because there are only two countries in North America. So here there is the caveat I was telling you that we're still understanding how to merge the EU dataset with the national dataset. For now, they are mostly separate. So we have the European Union as being the highest in this case. Also, we will need to include some of those entries in the other countries. On average, we find 24 measures. This is where the UK is. So given that we are in the UK, it's one of the most open country in when it comes to digital trade. And this is also what emerged from previous studies we did in the past. So UK is always towards the most more open side. In terms of policy areas, content access, so low restrictions on the access to information online, and then on technical standards for products, intermediate liability. On the other hand, still a lot of restrictions on pipe procurement, telecom, and online sales and transaction always appears as the highest because we have a lot of interest in this pillar. So it's also a bit biased, this first place there. And on the enabling side, again, this is the UK, so not as many measures as we like in terms of enabling policies as we would expect, given that the UK is also among the least restrictive. But here, yeah, there's less variation within Europe. So this was what we found so far. To conclude, what are we going to do next? As I was saying, we are increasing the coverage. So already by this year, you will have at least 10 more countries in our database from Latin America, and next year from Africa. We will release early 2023 the summary reports, in which we will show what is the variation we find in the data across different areas. So you really will have there a detailed analysis of what we have already in the database, only by using the qualitative information. And then we will release also the index on digital trade integration. And the idea is to update it every year to see how things evolve over time. And then we are also starting to conduct empirical analysis using the data. And by doing this kind of analysis, we can also identify areas of high potential for integration. And one of the study we're doing now is for UNECA, so the UN Regional Commission for Africa, and we are advising the negotiations of the African Free Trade Continental Area. And I wanted to show you just a couple of graphs of what we are starting to see with doing this analysis. Here you see the correlation between the number of entries in our database and the trading services and FDI. So you see already by just plotting these two that there's a negative relation. And what we are doing now is a heterogeneity analysis. So we're looking at country pairs and how different countries are in regulation between them. And we are plotting this into using it for a gravity analysis. And this is the preliminary results for Africa. So we see that, let me also show this. So this gravity model looks at the potential, the correlation between heterogeneity across areas in different policy areas and trading services. So what we find is countries that are more heterogeneous in chapter one, which will be tariffs, chapter two, that is public procurement, et cetera, so the more heterogeneous, the less trading services across country pairs. While those four areas, FDI, IP, intermediate liability, content access, are not found to be related with trading services. We are still investigating this result, understanding what is the reason. Because this is in Africa, probably a lot of the measures in content access, intermediate liability are related to political censorship and restrictions more than protectionism. So that's probably why they're not really related to trading services, but we are still working on this paper and we should be out by the end of this year. So I just wanted to tell you, show you what you can do with this data if you want to conduct some empirical research. That's it. Thank you for listening. I hope you then.
I'm gonna ask the panelists to join us at the front. Thank you very much, Martina, for a very interesting overview of the project and the first findings. Okay. We start with Graham. Comments or questions, or what are your thoughts on what you just heard?
Well, first of all, any data in the area of digital trade is welcome. As far as the British government is concerned, and I would hope anyone is concerned. Digital trade is a relatively young discipline. We've had e-commerce around for quite some time, but of a quite technical nature in WTO. And over the last few years, that's really opened up in terms of understanding the breadth of digital trade. We sometimes think of digital trade as a niche technical area in trade negotiations, but I think increasingly we are realizing that in fact digital trade is modern trade. It covers everything. And one of the things that I like very much about your scope, Marcy, is the fact that it doesn't just focus in on data flows. It doesn't just focus in on some of the areas that are very important for us in terms of international policy, but often cover up many, many other areas that are important in digital trade. We talked about procurement, for instance. We can talk about online sales. We can talk about trading systems and digital trade facilitation, such as electronic documentation. We still live in a world, in many parts of the trading world, which is back in the 17th century. There are still documents that, in order to undertake a contract, you have to have stamps, or you have to have a notary to come along and sign it for you. This is not the digital world in which many of us now live. And I think what's really important is that trading rules can catch up with the very rapid pace of change that has come in the real world of digital trade. So first of all, very welcome and great to see some of the very early analysis that you're starting to put together based on the data sets that you've got. Interested as well by the range of countries you've got in the different regions. Would be very interested to see what impact China has on your Asia Pacific data set. Asia Pacific is a very large region, which is really covering a number of important regions in its own right. So be interesting to see as you develop the data set and develop your analysis, how that breaks down. You've got the likes of New Zealand at one end and the likes of China at the other. But very interested to see what the impact of China itself has on those results. But I think overall, I would say that what is really heartening about this research, and there is other research starting to develop around the world, is that we are starting to understand the importance of digital trade and what it means for all of our lives. And particularly perhaps at the moment, with the global crisis, with the cost of living crisis, with the terrible war that we're seeing in Ukraine, we are starting to see and feel as individuals what it means when the global economy is not providing that prosperity that sometimes we take for granted. Trade is one of the positive areas in which we can raise prosperity, not only for ourselves here in the UK, which is very important, but also right across the world. And that's something that I think we've got to really focus on very much. But of course, digital trade is much more than that. It's not just about trade and growth. It's also about what kind of society we want to live in. It's about our values. It's about our privacy. And it's about the geopolitics of where we want to place ourselves as the UK and like-minded countries that share our values and our democratic outlook compared to others on the trading world who have a very different outlook and would like to use digital technology in rather different ways. So this all, I think, comes together to, in summary, to say that we really need to understand this much, much better. Because it's only with understanding both the value of digital trade, also the risks of digital trade, that we can better shape our policies. And that's what we want to do. We want to shape those policies for everybody. The final thing I'd say on this, and this is something that I think is really interesting about your work, Martina, is that we very often focus on the developed world when it comes to digital trade, for the reasons that you've demonstrated actually in your data sets, which is that we just have a lot more data based on the ability to look at the way in which, as developed countries, we use digital technology in our trading. It's absolutely imperative that as we go forwards, we include everybody in the world things. We mustn't just be motoring ahead ourselves and leave the developing world behind. And digital infrastructure is going to be absolutely critical to all of this. The OECD estimated that a 10% increase in digital connectivity leads to a 2% increase in trading goods and a 3% increase in trade and services. And that's before you get to all the other benefits that you get from data flows, which are now estimated to be many, many trillions of dollars. So this has got to be inclusive. It's got to be an inclusive digital trade policy. And I think having the data on these different regions, including Africa, including the Asia Pacific, right across the world, will really help us to understand that better.
Thank you very much. Sabina, you want to give your perspective?
Sure, I can try to respond to all of that. I would say I fully agree that this data is absolutely essential. We keep talking about digital trade, we keep trying to define it. I think the fact that you use a broad definition for it and that it includes pretty much everything, as soon as you kind of go through that list, you can realize that actually digital trade is pretty much trade and includes a whole set of services, but also trading digital products and goods. And I think that's where, it becomes, you kind of understand the scale of what you're talking, you put it in very good terms there. What I would say is, I'm really looking forward to the second part of the research, because I think that's really interesting, the enabling part as well, because it's also what you don't do or what you fail to do that contributes to just how restrictive or not restrictive you are. And I think that would be an important kind of piece of the puzzle to kind of get a really good picture. Now, of course, the UK ranks highly. We have a flourishing tech sector here, and they're doing very well in trading internationally. And they could always do better. It's a sector that's good at kind of picking up opportunities, and kind of flourishing in a system that's fairly open makes it fairly easy to then explore other markets. And fairly attractive markets are the ones that are similarly open. So, it's unsurprising that you will see increased trade in between the less digitally restrictive countries. And I'll be really interested to see, and I think you mentioned it before, but I'm not sure if you're looking into it here, whether, the more restrictive you are, does that increase trade in between the more restrictive countries? Does that create a separate bubble of sorts where actually more transactional trade is happening because of similar views of the world in a way. I think your point about enabling, and I want to go back to that on domestic regulation particularly, I think that's really a point that we are faced with a lot. I represent about 930 companies operating in the UK, also internationally. The biggest barrier to trade that they always talk about is actually the rules and regulations behind the border. It's less to do with anything else, out of all the restrictions you can think of, but that that barrier, that understanding what on earth they have to comply with, what is going on, and there's a lot going on. You mentioned some of the areas you're looking at. There is a lot going on in the international regulatory space on digital, whether you think of content regulation, online sales, if you think of online safety, competition in digital markets, data protection, data flows, all of that. There is a lot going on domestically and not enough going on internationally. And that's, I think, in part because, the gap has been widening in understanding of what these issues are and just how developed countries look at them. versus the rest of the world. It is a bit of a widening gap because we do so much regulation here, and there is a risk that we lose touch with what's happening in the rest of the world and how you basically broaden that conversation about digital trade measures in general. So I would say probably international regulatory cooperation is the biggest piece we can actually come up with, and that research will actually help in seeing where and how we can try to tackle some of those issues that you were raising, or some of those, you know, where the biggest differences are, what are the actual international bodies or where we can start tackling them. Because it's not necessarily free trade agreements. It's free trade agreements is one part of the jigsaw. But you have other international bodies. It's WTO, it's the OECD, it's the G7, it's the G20. It's various multilateral, plurilateral negotiations going on that, you know, tackle some of the issues, whether it's data, whether it's AI, whether it's competition, online safety, and so on. And I think part of the problem, and I think that's speaking purely for maybe Europe and North America, as you put them together, I'll put them together as well, is that everyone thinks they're doing a much better job than everyone else. So, you know, when it comes to digital regulation, there is a bit of arrogance going on in terms of, like, you know, approach. We all think, you know, and I think, you know, with this person, special point, finger pointed at Brussels, because that's where I live and work, you know, there is that arrogance that comes with being the first mover when it comes to digital regulation. And that, in a way, is a barrier to the broader conversation about how do we think about these issues together. Because it's not enough to create online safety or data protection or more competition in Europe. We need to think about this globally and with like-minded partners around the world. And maybe two small points to end. One is, you know, thinking of it, using this data to think about where does the world move in a bit of a post-FDA era. So I think we are, you know, the UK is still negotiating some really good agreements, but that road is coming to an end slowly in terms of, like, partners we can actually sign FTAs with. Europe is struggling to kind of pass some of the ones they've been negotiating for years through the ratification process. The US hasn't been doing trade agreements since the USMCA, and it's unlikely to anytime soon. So where do we move from here? You know, is the EU-US Second Trade Council, for instance, a forum to try to tackle some of these issues? Is then a scope for broadening that out to include the UK, Japan, other countries at some stage when it starts delivering and working bilaterally. So I think there is a point of thinking of, like, where do we tackle, as a policy response to your paper in a way, where do we start tackling some of this strictness was the best point, and was the best forum. And then one last point to kind of build on Graham's point on geopolitics. So I think there is something that happened immediately in the aftermath of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, that measures changed overnight, sanctions appeared overnight, you know, companies had to deal with, like, commercially meaningful kind of decisions in a matter of days and kind of, you know, remove themselves from Russia pretty much immediately. I'm wondering, you know, from a trade policy perspective, whether there are things we need to think about for the next possible big crisis. You know, what are some of the lessons learned from the aftermath, the immediate aftermath of the Russian invasion of Ukraine? What are some of the issues, we kind of processes or issues we need to be thinking about, you know, if and when a similar crisis occurs, in a way to prepare everyone for what a process in a case like this might look like, based on the sad experience we're right now. So I'll stop here.
Thank you very much, Sabina. Just quickly, can we actually switch off the projector so that Graham doesn't mind it?
What is it?
Okay, Sam, you want to react?
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much for inviting me. Thank you for producing this research. I'd like to echo what the others have said in terms of my appreciation for someone compiling something that allows for comparisons to be made. You know, because ultimately that's often what we're looking for. You know, someone says, well, is the UK good at this? I only know that if I'm able to compare it to others. And I'd also appreciate the fact that you've approached it broadly. Insofar as I was sort of looking, it flashed up briefly some of the lists of the different criteria. And you know, in there you had content moderation policy. And I think these are always an interesting one because people don't necessarily jump to that when you're talking about digital trade. And then you have to start thinking about, why could content moderation policies be a problem? And one of the reasons is if, for example, you are given 3 hours to respond to a government request to address something, take something down or the like, and you can only really do that if you're in country. But then this does get me to my question as to how did you go about qualitatively assessing these points, right? Because we think we can all agree that, say, a 3-hour window to take something down is probably a bit of a protectionist measure. 24 hours, 48 hours, and just wondering, sort of, I'm assuming there was a process as well, right? Because because as with all data, it's always you can't just say yes or no most of the time. Mm-hmm. There still has to be some sort of analysis done. And from your process, it looks like that was. I'd just like to hear a bit more about that. But then this gets me to my other question as well, because I think in terms of it seems as if you've assessed the bound regime, right? By which I mean what is there in the legal and regulatory text, which, as we know, doesn't always align with the applied regime,
yeah.
As in what actually happens in a country. And this is a problem with trade policy writ large, which is it's why you can't look at a trade agreement text and then know what you're allowed to do and not do in the country, because often it's sort of the lowest common denominator, and actually the applied regime can be much more liberal, you know, and or not in some instances. And I'm just wondering, sort of, if you've attempted to account for the applied regime at all, or if that's just too difficult. And I understand if that's too difficult to do, because I still think this is useful regardless. But it does throw up for me some sort of interesting questions around the integration piece, because the thing that stood out with Europe has the most sort of implementing recession. I think, but I know Europe isn't actually top of the table when it comes to sort of trade liberalisation in respect to digital services. So I'm thinking, how have you accounted for the lack of anything, an absence? Because, so say, lots of countries will not have done anything in a given space, and often that means that you're allowed to do it. So, for example, I think probably the answer is that you have to take it into account with the trade restrictiveness side as well, and you sort of balance it out. But the reason I'm asking this is less Europe and it's more the Africa piece, where my hunch is you can get away with quite a lot of stuff, right? So there's no rules either way, but actually in practice, because of in some countries diminished state capacity or inability to enforce, that actually lots of things might happen, or they might. I'm just wondering if that's sort of been thought of from a comparative sense. And I realise these are all sort of difficult things to deal with. I'm just interested in sort of hearing your views on it, and then to come back to then to close, I suppose. And it's back to this applied bound issue. We were discussing beforehand the issue that you have also in developed countries around the use of broad exceptions to actually override your system of rules and regulations. So, for example, national security, or in the financial services space, prudential regulation, or even public policy regulation. So great, I'm going to speak very positively and then tell you why it doesn't work quite as we have. But in the negotiations, the deals that Graham's done recently, for example, on financial services, there are provisions in there that prevent both parties from forcing financial services firms to store data locally as a condition of market access. Now, these are pretty liberal provisions, and actually, you know, you're at the forefront of what's possible. But in practice, do you often have to store data locally in the UK in order to operate here? Yeah, because of GDPR. Right, and that comes under the public policy space. So I suppose this is what I'm getting at with the sort of, is it even possible to like move from assessing bound to applied, or is that just a step too far? That's my question and where I end.
Okay, that's the holy grail of also OECD benchmarking. Also, it's quite a difficult one. Martina, do you want to perhaps quickly respond to some of these things? Perhaps we open it.
Maybe I start with some comments. First of all, thanks for. I'm glad that this is considered to be important somehow. Some things because you raised a lot of points. About China, the impact of China. I think, unfortunately, the impact of China when it comes to digital trade regulation has been very detrimental because China is seen as an example to follow too often, unfortunately. And also in Africa, we're seeing a lot of countries that really take China as an example. The problem is that what China has done is impossible to replicate in any other country. Perhaps India might be the only one, and they are moving in this direction. But otherwise, I really don't see it. And what don't see how this could bring any positive effect. What we're seeing now is perhaps in Africa with the African Free Trade Continental Area, with now 54 countries negotiating, they start to see also China as a model to follow at the regional level, which on one end is good because they want to remove restrictions within the region. On the other, of course, they're creating this kind of wall, but this also a bit what the EU has done. So we'll see where how this will move forward. But overall, I think China is created a lot of expectations that restricting somehow data or imposing a lot of control over digital trade brings benefits, which is not what we find with empirical research at all. It's easier to see and say, oh, China is has done it, so we could copy, than actually looking at the data and empirical research. And when it comes to empirical research, you were mentioning about bubbles, Sabina, of countries negotiating, trading with each other. We've done only one study on this for the World Bank that was published last year, in which we looked at more than 113 economies all over the world, and we focused on data policies personal data policies. And what we found is that countries sharing similar restrictive approach on data. For example, we call it the control model, which is the China model. So for countries following the China model don't trade more with each other, they trade less. So we find a very strong, statistically significant negative impacts of the China model on trading services between country pairs sharing this model. For the open model, which would be the US model, we find positive impact on trading services. For the European model, we call something like safeguards model, I think. What we find is negative or positive depending on the sector. So there is not very clear. I add another piece. What we did was looking at the cross-border and the domestic side. On the domestic side instead, what we found is that both the China model and the US model have a negative effect on trading services, where the EU model is associated with more trading services. So what we found is that sharing a regime in which you have no restrictions on the cross-border side, but also strong protection of the rights at domestic level is the one associated with most trading services across country pairs. This is just to say, there are bubbles, and we do see that sharing a restrictive regime, or at least on data, doesn't help. And behind the border, about the beyond the border part, of course, this is what digital trade is mostly about behind the border, and this is what we try to do in our database. So our database is mostly about domestic policies, we try to take into account this as much as we can. And actually, if you have other suggestions or other policies we should include, this is really open, right, for inclusion and suggestions. About cooperation. And this also links to your question about where can we address this? I agree with the fact that probably with FTAs you cannot go farther than we already have. So I think it's great to have other commitments, but then these commitments are always coming with exceptions that are, when it comes to digital trade, very vague and very hard to define. So the approach of digital economy agreements, the approach of the tech and the trade and technology council, I think is the way to go, is the only way to go, in which we sit at the table and we find just areas for interoperability, for harmonization of standards, because it is really what it is coming down to is making sure that these different regimes can talk with each other somehow. And at least among similar, like-minded countries, this is possible. But this is also possible, perhaps, with the other, with countries that are not always like-minded. And I think the example of Vietnam with a CPTPP that has made some kind of commitment on, for example, data, might be a good example. We'll see whether Vietnam actually does what they are supposed to, what they committed to do. But this also shows that there is some willingness from countries like Vietnam that are very strict on data to take some commitments. And India also recently has taken a commitment on data with the United Emirates. So like maybe something is moving there. Moving to your comments that are more about the substance of our methodology. So how do we select when a measure is a problem? On the content moderation part, the part about 1 hour, 3 hours, like what we do is that on average, we don't go into that level of detail just because it's very hard to find for each country. But what we do is that we present what the intermediate liability regime is. So what is the law and what is the number of hours that countries have if we find them, or otherwise we just write that there is an intermediate liability regime, which already is good, at least you have something. And we take into account complaints of companies that help us a lot to understand what is actually applied. So what is there on the ground. Sometimes a country can have a good law that looks great, but then there are also complaints from like international business associations or specific companies. And when the complaints are formalized, we include them in our database. So only when they are really like official complaints. So we try to go through this. We try to be as applied as possible. And then, of course, for tariffs or other things in which we can use applied rates, we do. We try to really look as much as possible to what's going on in the ground. And when it comes to enforcement, what is actually enforced, what is not, is, I think, impossible. it would require an effort. Already it took us about 2 years to finish this project. Moving to the enforcement part will take 20. I don't know, because it's very hard, especially for regions like Africa. We find that they have also copied and pasted a lot of EU regulation, like GDPR is like copied and pasted in many countries. It doesn't probably doesn't have any effects and in practice on the ground, and I think this requires some maybe like regional projects in which we go there and you see and study what is happening on the ground. But so we couldn't go into this level of detail. So for now, what we have is at least what is the regulation, which is already the first step, like for the country, at least you start imposing the law and then you start also, you go towards enforcing it. But also in the EU, like when it comes to GDPR, I wonder how many companies are actually complying with it. I think about the absence of rules. I think it goes in both directions, because not having rules in some areas allows companies to do whatever they want, but also in others doesn't protect them. So for intermediary liability, for example, you need to have a regime to protect intermediaries from liability. So in that case, the absence of rules means also that they're exposed. In other cases, it doesn't. What we do is we also look for these enabling policies and whether countries actually put in place all these policies considered good. And of course, in those countries that are most inactive, you find on one end less restrictions, but also less enabling policies. So I think it's kind of, cancel. The effect is like cancel. Yeah. I think that's.
Thank you very much. Are there already some questions? Okay, we have to follow, we have to have microphones. Yeah, maybe. Perhaps we start with the gentleman in the blue pullover, and then perhaps with you. And let's try to grab three and work through the notes.
Hi, thank you. That's very good. Hunter Matson, the Institute of Export and International Trade. So my question, I have two, are going to follow on Sam's qualitative questions. Have you considered the permanence of these, right? Because I think especially with sanctions with COVID, there were some temporary measures put in place. And so, you know, is this just cataloging all that ever was or only the active measures? And the second one is, you know, the universality versus the targetedness of these. Again, sanctions only apply to certain individuals or countries. So, you know, is that a level of detail that could be accounted for, or is that a step too far to gather? Thank you.
Well, thank you to all the panel. And my question is specifically to Martina. In a region as heterogeneous, politically speaking, as South America, like as Latin America, actually, did you find any correlation between like the ideology of the government and the enabling or restrictive measures for online commerce? That's my question. Thank you.
Good evening, Anar Breckenridge from Frontier Economics. So I guess your question in two parts, trying to bring both bits of the panel together. So starting with a nerdy structural gravity question. The gravity nerd in me rejoices at the development of the data. And one of the issues with count variables is understanding, I guess, the stringency of a particular measure versus another one. And related to that, I guess, is the issue of collinearity, the fact that there are a lot of these things moving together, which then confounds the estimates. So, you know, any tips of working around that? And then, I guess, related to the policy angle, I guess if you're, you know, a poor old negotiator or regulator working somewhere, you have this plethora of measures. You want to identify really the four or five you can go for, ideally in a negotiation or in a regulatory dialogue. Either you're really lucky to try and persuade the partner to change their ways, or at least persuade them to committing not to make things worse than they actually are. How do we move from this richness of the data we have to that specific policy concern?
Okay, thank you very much. Perhaps I can add a quick one for the panelists here. Sorry for four questions, but is there something missing from this data set? As far as you could actually tell from this brief presentation, nobody expects you to have obviously studied this guideline or overview, but is there something that strikes you as clearly being absent from this data set? I don't know, I guess the first few questions were to Martina, and then perhaps you can open it up to the panel.
Okay. About the first question, active measures, target measures. So for now, what we have in database is measures that are active now, 2022. We are kind of collecting as much as possible past measures, and we are saving them for something. Maybe hopefully we will also be able to publish them. And what is most interesting for us, also because we want to do empirical research, is having a panel data. So we're having an idea about what was the regime before this last measure. And we are already to the extent that was possible, always mentioning the previous regime, if the regime had imposed a similar restriction. So for example, for EU GDPR, we say it was in 1995 already the directive, and now this has been replaced, but the regime has already been there since 1995. So we write it already. In the database. And for targeted measures and temporary measures, we are also including as much as possible what is going on now in response, for example, to Russia. We have put, for example, the blocking of Yandex in Estonia that happened as a result, because it's still a trade restriction. It can be justified, but we don't really look at whether it is justifiable or not. We just say this is a cost, this is a trade restriction, and for this, I think if you are looking for what's going on now and what our country is doing. The digital policy alert of the Sangalli University is much better, because what they do is web scrapping, and they really have a lot of information there. Our database is more like selecting among what everything that is going on, what we think is actually having an impact on trade. Of course, there are probably there like more things that they have, like dozens of thousands of measures in there that that are also temporary. But we try as much as possible to take those into account, especially the DPA database is helping us to track all those temporary measures. So for the active part, we hope to expand to have also past measures and to expand and to have also panel data in the future. That's where we want to go. Hope I reply to all the parts of the question. Also when we want to target, when the major targets one country, we also include it. And we specify it in the coverage that the measure is affecting a specific sector or targeting a specific country. Also, it's rare that you have, like, most of the cases really on an MFN basis. For correlation between the political environment and digital trade policies. I think not only Latin America, but we see it broadly that in countries in which you have a regime that is authoritarian, you have more control of information, so more measures applied in certain areas. I can say some country like Egypt is a country that has a lot of control of information. Of course, China, we find Vietnam, Indonesia, Cuba is another. So we do see that for some policy areas, there is a clear correlation. We have not done any study, but you can see it, you can feel it when you see the data. And I think this is also an interesting area, because it is an area where digital trade is related with freedom of expression somehow, because not having restrictions like censorship or content or blocking of content or the liability of intermediaries or of obligations for intermediaries to monitor content is related also to freedom of expression. So it's the favorite area for me to work on, because it's good not only for trade but for society. In short, we see something, but we have never really focused on studying whether there's a clear correlation in specific areas. For the gravity model, it is true that when you have more restrictions in one pillar, you tend to have more restrictions in other pillars, but this is not always the case. So still the count of measures shows somehow the activity of the country. And of course, you're putting all sorts of controls to avoid collinearity. I'm not the economist on the team. I'm more the policy person, but there is an economist that making sure that we don't fall into these problems. But what also one reason why we're developing the index is to try to avoid just the number of the counting of measures, because also some measures are clearly more restrictive than others. So the index allows us to then take all of this into account. But then also on the index, we're like Robert knows about all our meetings. It's very hard to find the methodology that we are happy with. So for now, we are trying different things. And probably what we will do is to publish different indexes so that then the researcher can choose depending on what they feel is the best methodology. There are so many aggregating methodologies for aggregating measures, then we feel we cannot choose. At least I think there's advantages in each of them and disadvantages. So probably we will publish a few and then people can use them as they wish. And on identifying areas of action, this is exactly what we are doing and why we are now doing the gravity model. We have all this information, but of course, what we are interested in is eventually where can we have the most gains from some kind of harmonization or some action, or also low hanging fruits, like those in which we find that there is almost harmonization. So there's like little tweaks can make a difference and help to find a common ground. And I think, this kind of analysis, the gravity analysis we're doing helps in this direction is one thing. The other is more a qualitative analysis across all areas and then seeing where we find most diversity, also where we find the least amount of diversity. I guess it really depends also on what is the objective of the government, it depends on the country itself. There are different priorities that the country would have depending on their services, the exports in the country. So yeah, I guess this is just a tool that you can use in many different ways, depending on what is the final policy objective then of the country. I hope this replies.
Okay. So where did we mess up? What is missing? Like to see more action. Sabina, you want to prep?
Yeah, I can follow up from that. Very quickly, I'll start with a little anecdote on GDPR compliance. Once upon a time in a previous life that I'm very guilty of, I used to work on GDPR before it became law. I won't name the country, but we went to visit a data protection authority. So this is the commercial regulator in one of the European member states in Eastern Europe. We kind of walk in, we look around, and my first question is like, where are the actual computers? Because these people are doing data protection implementation in the country. And they go like, oh, those are with the Secret Service. That in the context of the whole national security access to data in the US and the Snowden revelations and everything was quite telling about how it is implemented and what the double standard in European member states versus if you happen to be outside of it. On what else we should be talking about, I think it kind of goes, because we're already talking about other things. And I think it goes to show the kind of growing gap that I was talking about earlier. Because in some of the modern agreements and in the digital economy agreements that Graham is guilty of, like me, of the GDPR, there are things in there around digital identity. There are things in there around online safety, which go beyond like just, you know, intermediary liability as a principle. And I think it kind of goes to show just how far that conversation is moving among the front runners in the space. And I think maybe one good example about on international cooperation that comes from the legacy practice of the regulators in that space is competition. You know, they automatically, by the nature of the job, had to work at international level and cooperate quite well. So maybe there is an element of, you know, harmonization. I mean, we don't like that word, but coherence that would actually come from the implementation of policy. You know, even if we do our own different things in various countries and regions on the planet, if, you know, when it comes to the actual enforcers and when it comes to the regulators, if there is a forum, and that comes with the kind of regulatory cooperation commitment, there is a forum for all these people to come together and share best practice and knowledge and the rest of it. Based on the model of the constitutional regulators, there is something we can actually build from that best practice.
Okay, thank you very much. Graham, do you see any gaps in the analysis that we should remedy?
Well, I think this is a very complex area that it is a challenge. And I think we need to be open about that. And I think one of the things that I welcome, Tina, is that you've been open about that from the start, as I would expect. I'm interested in the collinearity question. I think this is a really important one. I think there is a question about the qualitative difference in the impact of each of these restrictive or enabling measures. I think it's a good proxy to start with to talk about the numbers of measures, because that gives you, starts to give you a handle on what you're dealing with. But if one measure can have the impact of 100 others, that's, you're not getting that level of granularity that you need to understand what the impact is. But I'm sure that will come, and it's extremely challenging to measure. And so, you know, one step at a time. I'd like to come back to the policy question, which was asked, because as policymakers, we obviously rely on evidence, and it's absolutely fundamental to everything that we do. We need the evidence to be able to make evidence-based decisions. how we make those decisions depends partly on the amount of information and evidence that others can provide us with, as well as the amount of analysis that we can do ourselves. Remember, we have a lot of in-house economists, we have legal advisors, of course, as well as our policy experts. And when I go into a negotiation, I have a team that's made up of a range of different digital trade policy experts, but I always have a legal team and I always have an economics team at my side. How do you go about a negotiation to ensure that you try to cover as much of this as possible? And how do you prioritize, which I think was part of the question? I think the first thing is, like any negotiation, you go in with a maximalist approach and you test to see how far your trading partner wants to go with you, how far along the journey they want to go with you. And so in a way, the negotiation itself reveals over time what you're going to be able to achieve. As a process, it's quite a helpful process, actually, in terms of getting to the end. And that's why a negotiated solution, as in any other area of negotiation in life, is never the optimal for one country or another. We all have different domestic legislation. We have very different starting points often. We might have different policy objectives that simply can't be reconciled. But what we can do in trade negotiations is find where the common ground is and go as far as we can. And that's important because what we are seeing is an increase in the fragmentation of digital trade legislation and regulation around the world. And that is not good for any of us. And that is the process of domestic legislation that is being put down in various countries, as we've heard, without an understanding of how this all works together. Interoperability is the word that we use. Mm-hmm. Because we know that we are not going to be able to have a one-size-fits-all perfect solution that everybody uses. And that's simply not going to happen. But what we can do is we can increase interoperability of the systems that are already in place. Now, in terms of how you go about doing that, as we've discussed, there are FTAs, there are trade negotiations and trade agreements, and there are other tools as well. The powerful aspect of trade agreements is that you are negotiating an international treaty. And therefore, it has a power that a simple cooperation agreement simply doesn't have. It's extremely difficult to row back from an international agreement of that kind if it's got binding legal provisions. That's why trade agreements are so powerful. And that's why when we go in as the UK into any trade agreement, we're looking to see if we can find binding provisions that can lock in a regime between the two countries, the UK and the trading partner, that is permanent. Because pretty much everything else isn't permanent. And that's why that's so important. As well as that, though, we've gone further and we have developed cooperation agreements, particularly in the sidelines of some of our trade negotiations, notably the UK-Singapore digital economy agreement. Which can go further in certain areas, like digital identities, like data sharing, like a single window for customs authorities in countries to be able to work together and make their systems interoperable, all of which is going to help in terms of allowing trade to operate more efficiently, raising the bar and increasing prosperity for both sides. Now, in terms of how you go about doing that, there are a number of different ways you can do it. And the UK's strategy for the last 2 years has been a dual strategy, bottom up and top down. So first of all, we recognize that in the WTO, things move slowly. They move slowly because you've got over 100 countries, 150 countries, and you've got to try to find a deal that all of them will sign up to. At the moment, we've got the JSI e-commerce negotiations, specifically on digital trade, which has about 85 countries involved now. Getting an agreement across that number of countries, you know, we can all appreciate that is going to be tough. But if we can do it, that will become the new, or I should say, the only digital trade rulebook in the world, which is why it's so important and why the UK sees it important as pushing ahead on that front. And what we've done also top down is to use our G7 presidency last year to broker the very first set of G7 digital trade principles. When we started, everybody said it was impossible. You will never get the US, the EU, the UK, not to mention Canada and Japan, to agree on a set of digital trade principles. It just won't happen. Well, it did happen. And it happened because, first of all, we had the perseverance to keep going. But it also happened because the commonalities between the G7 countries are much greater than the differences. We often focus a lot on the differences. But when you look at those other data sets in other parts of the world, you realize actually that we're much more closely aligned. We are different. We have our different perspectives. We have our different policies. It's true. And when we came together and we managed to broker those G7 digital trade principles, a real breakthrough. That's top down. But it takes time. That's feeding through into the WTO negotiations. It's feeding through into the way in which other countries are now thinking about their own FTA negotiations. But what we also have to do is have a bottom-up process. And that's what we've been doing as well. So over the last 2 to 3 years, we have been ensuring that the trade agreements that we negotiate have digital right at the center of them. It started with Japan, where we negotiated our first very ambitious digital trade agreement within the FTA. We've done it with Australia now, we've done it with New Zealand, we've done it with Norway. And of course, we are very close now to acceding to CPTPP. That's the 11-member group of countries in the Asia Pacific, which will have digital trade as part of that as well. We have started negotiations with India, with Israel, with Switzerland now, which is going to be a really interesting one, as well as renegotiating FTAs with Canada and Mexico. All of these are going as well. All of these are going to be very important in terms of not only ensuring that we open up and maintain and largely bind in and provide certainty for the digital trade that we already have with these countries, but it creates a wider shaping of digital trade rules internationally. Because the more countries see bilateral trade agreements, including these sorts of provisions, the more that they will use them themselves. So that's the dual approach that the UK has got, and we're going to continue with that. And I think what's really interesting about this sort of analysis is we can start to see ways in which we might be able to push the boundaries even further. And the final thing I'll say on this is the UK-Singapore Digital Economy Agreement, because it is by far the most ambitious digital trade agreement that's out there. That is a classic example of combining binding legal provisions that lock in data flows on a permanent basis that no other international agreement so far can do, with those cooperation agreements that are so important for developing the cutting edge areas of artificial intelligence, fintech, even law tech, which was a world first in that agreement as well. So lots going on there. And this sort of evidence is going to really help you get this.
Okay. Thank you very much. Sam, do you...
So just to agree with Graham on praising and encouraging the sort of qualitative aspect of it, in that, so Global Trade Alert, which created Digital Policy, that is a great website, but it doesn't tell you enough. Right, and that's not because it's not trying to, but it's got its function, whereby 100 different trade defense measures you know, if you compare that to, say, 100 trade defense measures on China versus one country that bans all trade with China, that's 100 to 1, but actually the impacts are quite different. So going into that is great. In terms of your question, which was things that were missed, when I first think about that, I thought maybe censorship. I don't think you have missed that. Because censorship is the one that I find quite interesting, because in the digital space, if you start applying it to movies and video games, in terms of, you actually start to hit some pretty big numbers quite quickly, right? You know, if you say you can't release the new Marvel film in country X, what's the impact on trade of that because of censorship? Or you can't release video, get this brand new Call of Duty or something, you know. And the reason I think focusing in on that and honing in on it is probably useful is that governments will love you for it, because all of a sudden they can say, look at these big numbers on these trade restrictions that we can directly apply. And you know, there's an element of that in everything, which is, and it's useful to anyone working on trade to make us feel better about what we do and its importance. In terms of looking forward, I don't know if you have missed much. But I wonder if there's just a need to ensure it evolves as regulation evolves. So one of the areas where I think we will see new barriers is in restrictions on the ability of people to provide services cross-border virtually over platforms like Zoom, or in, or in virtual reality type environments. So what I mean is the immigration regime being transposed into the digital space. So the reason I wonder about that is because, so say now, if I'm going to be paid to deliver some work in Belgium personally, I might need to get a work permit. But if I had to do that over Zoom, I wouldn't. And I wonder if at some point governments might say, well, there's a reason we had that restriction for in-person delivery, and you're creating the same negative effect on our domestic workforce, whatever they believe, and they try and push it into there. I wonder if that's also true of licensing, just in more requirements to have qualifications recognized in different spaces. And I'm not sure if that is in there, might be. Yes. It is in there, fine. So you've already got it coming.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. Very, very interesting to hear about your thoughts. Perhaps we can give the floor again to the audience. I think the lady in the back, then you in the front, please. Anybody else? Otherwise.
Yes. Hi, thank you to the panel. I apologize for the late entry, but it's a great discussion. So, my question is, the world is getting flatter with countries like India and South Korea coming in the limelight, but is it really possible considering West's, this is my opinion, United States of America's poison and police strategy in various nations such as Korea, Iraq, and the East, China's Hawkeye strategies in Vietnam and Africa, in terms of digital I'm talking about, do you really believe that there's a point where the leveling field would indeed be not about the West and the East anymore?
Can you perhaps rephrase this question, because I'm not sure.
Okay, so the pretext is that the world is getting flatter with digitalization, hopefully, but considering that United States of America's poison and police strategy and the China's Hawkeye strategy in countries like Africa, considering that they have invested a lot of amount of in the digitalization in Africa and they found a lot of things. My question is, do you really believe that there is a point where the leveling field is not about the West and the East anymore?
Thank you. I think there's just one sitting next to the one.
Great, thank you, Christine. I'm Malin from SAPL. I have a question. When you speak about digital trade, my first thought was digital trade depends on physical infrastructure. In your enabling conditions, are you looking at how vulnerable countries are to, for example, extreme weather events, especially at their infrastructure when it comes to digital space?
Another gentleman in the front here.
Hello, yeah, I came here as an economist, and I was trying to see, what I first of all thought I was coming to see was to see what the impact of this was. And we had something called digital trade openness, but in an early stage, it was we were told it's more than e-commerce. In fact, it's all modern trade. Possibly it's all trade. So I was trying to get some idea of what impact these things have upon the level of trade. And this, I might be far too heavy to try and ask that question, and maybe I am, because you suggest there's a lot of work still going on. And I was certainly interested in the whole question of, you know, how do you weight these things merely by the fact they exist or don't exist, and whether we can see any relationship at all between their existence, the extent of their existence on trade occurring. However, I got frustrated by that because I could see that at this stage we couldn't really answer that question, and I became much more interested in the second question, which was that we had a lot of data that was presented to us by sort of broad geographical areas, Europe's, East Asia's or something like that. But I was interested in this notion of blocks and bubbles and fragmentation, because this is what we actually do talk about quite a lot these days. And we didn't really have any blocks put there, except that at one stage the EU came up as something, although its member countries were also there individually, whether or not the UK was there or should have been there or should not have been there. But I was interested in the notion of blocks, bubbles, because, I mean, there are things, there are equivalent things to the European Union which could have been put there and which were not mentioned. And I wasn't quite sure why they weren't mentioned, except that in the discussion they sometimes were mentioned. And I was much more interested then, as a consequence, in what was going on within these new fragments that we're talking about, if we were talking about outcomes and impacts of any of this. Was something going on within these fragments that was different from what was going on within the entirety? And how do you identify these fragments? And in fact, does things like trade regulation, trade enabling, actually give you a way of identifying what these fragments actually might be? So you're kind of building up cluster analysis like that. Those are a lot of points. They're not necessarily questions, but I just chuck them into the discussion because it's my job to do things like that. Thank you.
Well, it's just a broad question. I was just wondering, would countries like Cuba ever change their regulations to policies and digital trade, or countries also like Cuba? Would that ever happen in the near future, or that's depending on the person who comes into power?
We can all hope so.
No Cuba specialists here, I guess. But
You could answer it for, say, China. Can I just come in on that one quickly? Because one of the most interesting things to happen in the digital trade space in the last, say, 6 months, or not really, not longer than that, is China has asked to accede to CPTPP. And the reason I find that interesting is that if you look at the digital commitments within CPTPP, they're on the face of it contrary to China's domestic regime. So one of two things is true. Either China is going to change so as to comply with what most people believe those rules to mean, or those rules don't mean anything. And both of those two things are really interesting, because you could write quite a lot about either.
Yeah, Martina, you have 3 minutes to respond to everything.
There was the question about West and East, so I wonder whether, like, maybe I leave the words to the other and then I can respond at the end, so they have a bit more time. I don't know if you have something.
Perhaps I actually used to work at the OECD, and there obviously do a lot of this benchmarking exercise. I don't think that necessarily if you make comparability the emphasis of the research, it means that everybody will end up on the same level. It's just making things comparable in the end, to some extent. And I see you're skeptical, but I mean, at least we then have some information.
Because the question is powerful and it's a diplomatic answer. So
And I've always received diplomatic answers for that question. Because you've always mentioned United States, India, China, these countries come up. So I get it.
Yeah, please go ahead.
So I think it's a very interesting question. I mean, it's a geopolitical question.
It is.
And I think it links quite neatly to the point that you were making about blocks and bubbles. Because what we're seeing at the moment is the world fragmenting into certain regional patterns. You know? It's not about fragmentation necessarily of simply individual countries. Mm-hmm. It's about fragmentation of blocks.
Yeah.
And that creates a really different level of risk. Because if we enter a world where we don't have one single ruble, and we are trading in different regions in different ways, then not only will the protectionist result of that be greater, very probably, it also raises important questions about society, about information, and so on. And actually, it comes to the question of, are there individual countries who are going to change because of digital trade? So I think we could, there are many scenarios, but you can think of two broad scenarios. One is that digital trade does allow for a greater amount of information sharing, which helps all of us understand one another better. Yeah? So whether that's that streaming of news, whether that's music streaming, whether that's simply trading in digitally delivered services, or whether it's about internet shopping on the internet. All of these things are not only about trade, they are also about what it's a way of all of us understanding how we operate now and how we think. And that's a really important element of how we are going to progress in the future as a world. So that's on the optimistic side. On the not so optimistic side, what we could see is a much greater integration within regional blocks, but a divergence of those blocks from one another. And I don't think anybody has the answer to that question yet. And that is why the rules of digital trade really matter, and they're up for grabs. So what we need to do as a world, as an international community, is to ensure, one, that we try to develop a rule book that we can all agree on, even if it's a lowest common denominator. And secondly, of course, I would say this from a UK government perspective, a world in which we can respect one another and we uphold certain values. And that's what we're fighting for here. It's not just about trade policy, it's something even bigger than that.
Okay, thank you very much. Martina, sorry, perhaps you have to wrap it up
very super quick. About this, I totally agree, and that's why I'm in digital trade, because I think it goes well beyond trade. I really don't care much about trade per se. I care about having the world which is united and connected, and I think digital trade can help to do that. So so that's why about Cuba, I think that things are inevitable. So we will see inevitably a change, at least in certain area, and we're already seeing it in China, more openness in when it comes to content access, to internet availability. It's coming, and it is inevitable. And about infrastructure, your question, the reason why we exclude all these things is that we only want to focus on regulatory policies, because there are a lot of other databases covering infrastructure, skills, and things which are super important and probably more important, but our value added is to focus on policies. So that's I think I stop here on blocks. There was more, but maybe I'll tell you later. On this.
Well, thank you very much to the panelists.